How can we show more kindness, respect, and love to the animals we share this planet with? What lessons can we learn from non-human animals about living in greater harmony with nature? Ingrid Newkirk is the founder and president of PETA, actively leading the organization and advocating for animal rights. Under her leadership, PETA has achieved significant victories, such as ending car crash tests on animals, pushing major fashion brands to go fur-free, influencing Ringling Brothers to become an animal-free circus, and helping pass a law that allows the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to approve new medications without conducting cruel tests on animals. Ingrid has written 14 books and has been featured in major publications like The New Yorker and The Guardian, and was the subject of HBO's documentary, I Am an Animal, and was named one of Forbes' 100 Most Powerful Women. She joined One Planet Podcast to reflect on her 75 years as an animal rights advocate. Ingrid Newkirk, welcome back to One Planet Podcast and the creative process.
Thank you, Mia. Delighted to be here. Thank you for doing this show.
I also should wish you a happy birthday.
Yeah, thank you very much. I'm the same person I always was, except my knees are a bit weaker now.
And so as you look back, you know, on these 75 years, most of us do know a bit about PETA, but just tell us, for those who don't know the whole history, how you came to found it and your path to becoming the animal rights activist you are today.
Well, Mia, I grew up like many people, really loving animals. I had a dog who was like my brother when I was growing up. And I really felt that I was a kind person. My parents were kind, but we ate animals. We wore animals. I had my first fur coat when I was 19. I didn't think about the products that I bought. And I even went to the circus and I saw elephants stand on their heads and bears on bicycles, all that sort of thing. And so through a series of experiences, I came to realize that I was supporting very cruel operations that denied animals everything that is precious to them. And so after that time, I thought, well, if I, as an animal person, didn't realize what was going on, how meat comes to the table, how leather shoes are made, how cosmetics are tested in rabbits' eyes, how wild animals are taken out of the forest, their homes, and used in circuses, kept in cages, then there are a lot of people just like me who need to also know what I have learned. And so we formed a little group, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, to show people exactly what goes on behind the scenes, places they'll never see. They only see what's in the forefront that looks all happy and joyous and available. And then with that group, we don't want to make people sad. We don't want to make people just angry. We want to empower everybody to be an important, conscientious consumer. And through their actions and what they buy and do, they are helping animals every single day, many times a day.
Tell us about some of those animal friends you've had along the way who have been your teachers or mentors in a way.
I have had so many wonderful animal friends, parents, family members in my life, starting with the dog who was there when I was born, Shawnee, who I grew up thinking I was his brother, and I don't know what he thought. But one animal sticks out in my mind, of course, they're all wonderful, and that is my Conchita Marie, who was, she's gone now, a little mixed chihuahua, fox terrier, something, who knows. We took over, PETA took over an animal shelter in Maryland, and it had been a disgrace. It was filthy, it was cold, it was awful. Somebody won the contract to reform it. So we went in at midnight one night to take it over. It was the beginning of a new era. And all night we cleaned, and there was one, this little dog who happened to be Conchita Marie, in her cement kennel. In the cold, she was almost bent in half like a banana. She had a cramp and she was standing on a wet floor. And I thought, oh, she's one of those little dogs who, you know, is feisty and she'll try to bite me because I'm a stranger. So I put a coat over her and picked her up and moved her to a comfy place in a room on a little comfy bed where she could be warm and snuggle. We worked all night, and then morning came, I was going to put her back in her kennel. I just couldn't do it. I thought, she's too small. So I took her home, and I looked and looked for her owner. It had been the snow on the ground, and she'd been found outside, and she was almost hairless. And I kept her advertising. No one ever came for her. And in the end, I said, all right, I'll keep you. And from that day on, she was the naughtiest dog you could ever imagine, barking at everybody. But she was the love of my life for many, many years. She died when she was probably about 17.
It's always sad when we lose a close companion. It goes beyond any words or any ways we can express that closeness. You know, as you say, when we reflect on our future on this planet, there's so much that we can learn from non-human animals in terms of living in harmony with nature. And what are some of those things that you've learned?
Well, it's true. I mean, why should it be one day when we think about our entire home and the future of the planet? It needs to be that we think about the earth, the animals, what we can do for our health, all those things every day. And you're right. Because if you take a place like Alaska, which was forever, millennia, a pristine wilderness with waters that were clean, land that was fertile, beautiful trees and flowers, and all the species from whales to turtles to beavers to muskrats to insects, all over the place, billions upon billions of animals. It was still clean as a whistle, still pristine. They know how to live in harmony, and they know how to protect the earth. No one taught them. There wasn't a lesson in school. There wasn't a video. That they've managed it. Then in come human beings, and we put up oil rigs, and we drill, and we put up our skating rinks and our shopping malls and our highways. We need so much. But it's not need, it's greed. So we need to learn from the animals how to live more gently and consume less and be more thoughtful and look out for each other in this great circle of life.
That's really a beautiful message. And I love just trying to imagine if it were possible for human beings to live in greater harmony with the planet the way non-human animals do. I just love reading in your books about the different ways they communicate and just their language. This has been a thing that some people, even very enlightened people, have used to say, what distinguishes us from animals, that they don't have a language. This is so false. And also this other idea that they don't have a conception of death. Sometimes I hear people say that, and I don't even understand that as a statement.
We definitely know that all animals have language. They talk to each other. They understand each other. And they have interesting ways of communicating that only recently have we figured out, even in part, because rhinos use a breath language. Fish use luminescence. Squid can actually send different messages, one on one side of their body and one on the other side of their body, with color and light and patterns. So they can ward off an enemy on one side by looking very fierce. And on the other side, they can be greeting a friend. So we do know cows have facial expressions that are so subtle, you can't really notice them. And that cats and horses use their ears and their tails and their whiskers and so on. Animals communicate with sounds too. And we know that elephants rumble and they purr and they almost growl, but they do it subsonically under the ground. And you need instrumentation to capture that sound. Humans can't really get the nuance of it. And it's not just sound. It's that a mile away, another herd of elephants hears that. And they don't just think, oh, there's a herd over there making a noise. They know that that means there are people with guns threatening our children, or we have found water. Come over here and enjoy it. So yes, all animals have language. Birds have amazing language. And you have to sometimes capture it and slow down the recording to find all the notes that they're using in between like dolphin clicks that you can't hear with the human ear.
Really, they're just artists. I feel like it's only when we maybe even approach or somehow get a little bit close to the abilities of animals, we call someone a great artist or a great athlete after years of training. Can you imagine being able to speak one side of your body with the different colors? It's too amazing.
And they're artists too, Mia, of course, yes. As you well know. I mean, divers went down into the sea and they couldn't figure out what these alien patterns were. Magnificent circles with all sorts of swirling patterns, all symmetrical, geometrically perfect in this vast design. And it looked as if alien beings had descended from another planet and made this pattern on the ocean floor. Turned out it was this tiny fish who uses his fins to carve this out so perfectly so as to impress a female fish. And we've also seen, for example, the bowerbird. The bowerbird goes out and collects anything shiny or pretty, just as we might decorate our homes. The way an octopus decorates their home with shells, the bowerbird brings back yellow flowers and red flowers and even little plastic things that he finds, and he makes an entranceway that is so spectacular to his beautifully woven nest and makes a little walkway that's all decorated so as to say to a prospective partner, Look what I've done. Come and admire my handiwork. And it is admirable. I couldn't do it, but they are very artistic.
Oh, definitely. And what's interesting about all of these instances is this artistry is not one of being dominant over nature. It's still utterly in harmony.
Oh, it absolutely is. And when you see a bird or even a squirrel make a nest, you have to be absolutely stunned at the talent. I mean, if you look up in a tree, can you imagine going and finding a twig somewhere and putting that first twig in the crook of a tree up so high and then going and getting a second twig and trying to keep them from falling off the branch and then weaving all these other twigs in this intricate design, and then filling the bottom of the nest with moss, or sometimes birds and squirrels will pick up plastic to try to make it rainproof. They've learned what that is. Sometimes they'll take discarded cigarette butts and stick that between the twigs to repel insects. I mean, this is all so clever. It's so artistic. It's so talented. And it's almost impossible for a human being with fingers on both hands to figure out how we could do that ourselves. Yet they do it, and they do it every year, and they do it again if a storm knocks down their nest. We should be in awe and respect animals, absolutely. We are all animals. Yeah, of course, as you know, is that we tend to say humans and animals, but really, we're all animals. And Biology 101 teaches us that. And people tend to say, such and such an animal has this human trait, or they share this human trait. They're not human traits. They're all shared traits. Because, of course, we all love our families or not, but we all grieve if somebody we love disappears or dies, a family dog, perhaps, a grandfather. We all feel loneliness. We all feel joy. We all really value our freedom. And so I think if anything, looking into the eyes of the animal, even online, you see a person in there. There's a someone in whatever the shape or the physical properties of that individual are. And that lesson is that I am you, you are me, only different. We are all the same in all the ways that count. Little things don't count. How much fur you have or don't have, whether you have fins or you don't have them. Any living being teaches you, look into my eyes, and there you are, the reflection of yourself.
It goes back to what you were saying about whether we once had the different language abilities that animals have and whether we've lost them. And I think that that extrasensory perception, some people are tuned in, you know, and then there's others that aren't. But I do think it is possible. And when you're young, when you have fewer barriers, like when you're a child, I remember I was so young, but I went into a field and there was a buffalo and they were terrified that I'm this baby in a field with a buffalo. But there was a trust. And when that trust is there, you can't be harmed. So I don't know if I understand what the buffalo is thinking, but it understood not to be threatened by me. And
well, that is true too, Mia. I think you've touched on an extremely important point, because other animals recognize human children and their vulnerability much more than humans recognize the vulnerability of other animals' children. Often there are cases of a dog or a bear or a wolf, or any animal in the woods, in the forest, in the jungle, who will protect a human child until that child can be found. And these are not myths. These are not fables. These are real stories where somebody is so thankful that that dog or whichever animal it was laid on top of that or next to that child to keep them warm through the cold or to protect them from marauding predators or whatever, or went into a lake and pulled a child out who had fallen in. Animals alert us to fires. They smell with their wonderful sense of smell, smoke or flame, before we do, and come and wake us up to say, get out of the house. So I think, yes, they have amazing senses that we don't have or have forgotten.
And so where do you think your sense of injustice and awareness of advocating for animal welfare stems from?
Well, I was always absolutely furious if I heard of anybody doing something like, and it did happen, beating a dog or starving a horse or something like that. But for years, even though my family and I considered ourselves, quote, animal lovers, we never connected the dots. So we ate lots and lots of different kinds of animals, had dairy products galore, lots of cheese. I had leather shoes that I was very fond of. My last pair of leather shoes was a pair of Basswegians that I thought were fabulous. I wanted to have a falcon on my arm because my uncle was a falconer. And all these things that just, I was so slow to realize that half of the things I did with animals, like ride horses, I grew up in India, went on elephant rides, that they were exploitive, they were domineering, they were really not respectful of animals. Liking and loving animals shouldn't mean taking from them, stealing from them, killing them, and just not considering how they feel about things. They're not volunteers. So slowly, as my eyes opened and I gained experience seeing animals in trouble, like a fox in a steel trap, like a pig abandoned on a farm, all these things that I saw, I thought, I need to tell other people about these things because they may never know. They'll be as oblivious as I was, as my family was. And I want to be sure to also not have them be upset and cry or get angry, but know that there are wonderful alternatives to every cruel thing. So I had to set out to do work to get those lists ready for them of shampoos that weren't tested on animals' eyes and beautiful fabrics that you could have and so on, and meals that didn't come from animals. And that's how People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals was born.
And you've accomplished so many great things because now so many of those choices are mainstream, and now veganism is mainstream. But with PETA, of course, sometimes you use non-traditional methods of getting your message across, like your Hell on Wheels exhibitions, life-size PETA exhibit designed to look like a transport truck with images of real pigs heading to slaughter painted on the outside of these trucks, highlighting in this very visceral way that humane meat is a myth.
Yes, we're bold, and our modus operandi is to make sure someone sees and hears about the plight of animals. So that may involve doing something really gimmicky. We're not afraid of making idiots out of ourselves. Anything we can do to turn heads, start discussion. We don't mind if people disagree with us. I mean, we'd rather they didn't. But if they do, and a lot of them do, because it's the first time they've heard a provocative message that challenges things they've always been doing, then at least it starts the discussion. And they may then hear about it in another forum, another way, and that all adds up. And so that helps them get towards change. And change does come, as we've seen. You just have to go to the grocery store and see all the things marked vegan, even in a small town or in a regular supermarket, and you just know it's arrived. So there were many pitfalls. The people mocked us mercilessly when we first started to say, fur is dead, fur is cruel. Little girls shouldn't wish to grow up to be fur wearers as some sign of success. It's not success. It's a sign of callousness or ignorance. And people said, how dare you? Now, when we said, elephants don't belong in the circus, people screamed at us as they were going into the circus. They swore at us. They mocked us. I mean, we've always had to put up with that sort of thing, but it doesn't bother us because we see that over time, our message resonates and people come to think, well, maybe elephants should be respected and should be left in the wild. And maybe it isn't right to have them stand on their heads and do stupid tricks. And maybe we don't need fur. And now, of course, people are saying, maybe we don't need leather or wool or feathers. We're not survivalists. We don't need to kill and exploit animals and factory bomb them for their skins and their hide and their flesh. And we don't need to test things on them. We've got technology. So everything that we have said from the start, which has been considered entirely envelope pushing, is now being worn away to be, well, maybe they have a point.
Yes, indeed. And you were, I think, among the first, you've actually inspired a lot of environmental movements as well, who understand that you have to get those images out. Tell us how you came to embrace different media to get your message across.
Well, media has changed so much, of course. And when we began, which was 1980, there was no internet. We started by handing out leaflets on the street, having a banner at national parades, which could be seen on television, doing undercover investigations like the Silver Spring Monkey case, which made the front page of the Washington Post. And in the beginning, you could actually go on a talk show and spend an hour discussing things in depth, seriously, showing photographs, having facts and figures. Today, it's the era of the soundbite. And so very few people get a very serious look at the issues. And so you have to adjust as the media has adjusted. And that's why sometimes we use gimmickry, because just having the facts, sadly, isn't enough. You can't give people just solid facts. It's boring to them. So you have to create a ruckus and make them have a look. I mean, sometimes we're like a car crash. Nobody can avoid turning around to see what it's all about. That's why we've used sensuality and sexuality, and we've used humor. We've used all those things with everybody voluntarily getting in on the act to say, I want to do something to make people aware of the reality, the horrors that animals are enduring. So that's how we've adapted.
Yes, and we should just say you're just reflecting back in the mirror, because sometimes it's just the image itself that's shocking. It's not that you have to amplify it in any way. So I'm just looking at some of your protests of you being arrested after running in front of hunters to free pigeons before they were slaughtered at the Higgins pigeon shoot, or you've been photographed hanging naked from a meat hook at a meat market next to the bodies of pigs for the ad for the Go Vegan campaign. So really creating these powerful images that people can't ignore. Can you discuss some of those campaigns and how they resonated with people?
I think things do change because of agitation. So agitation is vital. I mean, nobody who is in a cause should be there to win a popularity contest, whether you're working for children or the elderly, or working for peace, animals. It's all against nonviolence, aggression, domination, and needless cruelty and suffering. It's all for respect. So you have to be vigorous. You have to use your voice. You can use it politely. But if people don't listen, at PETA, we escalate. So we always start off with a polite letter, a polite entreaty. We always try to, as I say, do the homework So we have the options that we put out on the table to say, look, instead of doing this, you could do that, and we will help you transition to that. It's like in school, if people, poor children, are given a frog and told to kill them, or they arrive dead, covered in formaldehyde, and they're told to dissect them. We think that's obviously a desensitizing lesson, which can lead to them being desensitized to other issues, including to the fate of their own classmates that they may bully. And so we say, here's an alternative. It's called a synthetic frog or a synth rod, and it's made of plastic, and you can cut it open and take out the little organs with your forceps. There are no intestines to dangle in little girls' faces, and there's no stench of formaldehyde, and you can reuse it. So we're always doing that all the time. And everything we do is to say, come on, let's work with you. But if we have to escalate, we escalate. And I'll give you one example. For example, baboons and pigs used to be strapped into these cars with no sides on them and slammed into brick walls. And that was to record the injuries, the damage, the deaths. And we went to all the car companies and said, may we meet with you with our scientists? May we come up with alternatives to this so that you stop doing that to pigs and baboons or any animal? And they wouldn't listen. They turned a deaf ear to us. They wouldn't meet. And so we began by petitioning them. We began by having people who had that make of car write to them with a picture of their car saying, I will never buy this brand again. They still didn't listen. We went into auto showrooms and handcuffed ourselves to the models of those cars. They still didn't listen. So in the end, we had members of ours donate their used cars of that kind, whatever it was, and we set fire to them outside auto showroom. And boy, then they sat up and listened. For the first time, they decided, I don't know where this campaign is going, but these people are tenacious and they are determined to stop our animal use. And so they stopped it. And when you see mannequins on television or on the internet about car safety, that's because of our campaign. No car company in the world uses animals now. It's all mannequins. It's all technology. And so that was the example of how you couldn't just walk away when they ignored you and think, well, let the baboons and pigs die badly. You had to say, listen, listen to us. We're trying to be polite. We're trying to be nice. We're giving you the alternatives, but we are not going away until you stop.
And so when you were in India, you assisted your mother who volunteered for Mother Teresa. I'm wondering if your mother was as outspoken as you are.
When I was a child in India, and my mother was a sort of full-time volunteer for all sorts of things, children really called to her. And so she volunteered a lot for Mother Teresa's orphanages in Old Delhi. And together we would make toys for the children. She always made wonderful teddy bears and little cloth dolls, and we would stuff them and deliver them to the orphanage. She also took in unwed mothers who were cast out by their families and looked after them. But everything she did, she worked for a leper colony for a while, and we used to pack pills together when I was home from school, roll them up and send them to the colony. But she always said, it doesn't matter who suffers. It's that they suffer. And what can you do to stop that suffering? And that's the environment I grew up in. She was mild-mannered. She would give the shirt off her back to anybody. Our home was always full of refugees. There were Tibetan refugees, actually. People would come over the mountains from Tibet after the Chinese invasion and were living in Delhi and had nothing. And she would buy things from them, their handicrafts, and give them a place to stay. But she also would stop the car if she saw an animal in trouble. And we would minister to that animal, either take them home or get them veterinary care. Or in one instance, I remember, she wasn't with me, but from her lessons, I made sure to stop a man beating a bullock who was pulling a cart and was totally exhausted and had collapsed.
Wow. And it's wonderful how that informed your sense of compassion and fairness. And I guess also on the other side of that, your father worked for the defense industry. So maybe you're awakening to it. I'm just telling me a little about that.
My father designed bombing systems for war. And that's why we were in India, because the Indian government had contracted with him from a private company. He didn't work for the government because India was expecting a war with China, which luckily did not materialize. But yes, he also thought of himself as a kind man, but a practical man. He had a sort of disciplinarian Victorian sense of being. But in his practicality, for example, there was a rooster next door to us at one point who was making a lot of noise, and he made sure that the rooster was killed. So it was that old-fashioned view of he would never imagine doing anything unkind to a dog or anything unkind at all that fell within his understanding of what that meant, which was sort of never depriving them of their freedom to roam if he had a dog, teaching his dog how to count. He would give his dog treats and say, one, two, three, and he adored his dogs. But there were blind spots, and we all had them.
Yes, really, we all have blind spots. So what do you say to those who feel that animal rights activism competes with human welfare concerns?
I always remember when I first came to America, I saw a Life magazine pictorial, and it was white young men and women, mostly young men, going down to the South to register black voters. And you can't say it now, but they were screaming, "You white N words," at them. And they were saying, "What about the white babies in Appalachia? Why aren't you looking after them? You know, there are white people with problems, and here you are down here looking after these N words." And I always thought, you know, it's the same thing, is that we're all one. It's all about discrimination. We are one animal among many. Why should we consider our compassion only go to ourselves, our immediate family, maybe our race, maybe our country, maybe our religion, maybe our species? Why not just be kind? Why not be compassionate? Why not open your heart and say, if there's anything I can do for anyone, that's fine. And some of us, like my mother, had a talent for children. And I have a way of understanding other species, some of them, not all of them. Oh, not that I'm discriminating against them. It's just you have a natural understanding or you don't. And some people understand animal liberation is human liberation. Because if you only care about humans, then care about them clogging their arteries with animal flesh and dying of heart disease, cancer, stroke, high blood pressure. So if you only care about humans, which is very selfish and narrow-minded, then care about animal rights, because you will care about humans too. You will not destroy the rainforest to grow animals. And the rainforest means climate change for all human beings.
Indeed. And of course, in your book, Animal Kind, and your other books, you mentioned having this ability to understand or communicate in some way with the non-human animals that we share this planet with. And you're talking there about the ways that PETA has embraced technologies and media for getting the message out. And now with the rollout of generative AI, we see on the horizon maybe the possibility of furthering our ability to communicate or at least decipher the language of animals. So what are your reflections on this and developments in that regard?
Some of it's quite good and some of it is a little worrying. But I think one of the things about AI is it can distill a massive amount of information in a very short period of time. So the facts are on our side when it comes to the use of animals in experimentation. It's old-fashioned, it's out of date, it's ineffective. Almost 100% of the use of animals in experimentation doesn't work when someone tries to translate it into human use. That's why we have all these disclaimers on drugs saying, watch out for side effects from anaphylactic shock to death. So AI can actually distill this information and say, but state of the art methodologies exist, whether it's human organs on a chip, it's high speed computers that are programmed with human information, not something from a rat or a monkey, which is physiologically unaligned with us. And so it allows scientists, experimenters, to quickly see their options rather than have to dig around and debate them. I do believe it also helps shame people who are clinging to old ways of using animals by saying, modernize, get with it, it's 2024 or it'll be 2025. So technology has been our friend in many ways, although, of course, you've got people like Elon Musk who are trying to generate a brain chip and put it in human heads. He actually has just done the first one and has gone through hundreds of pigs and monkeys. And the stories coming out of his labs are very frightening as to what his callousness and how he has treated those animals and how badly they have fared and died. So it can go both ways.
And I know that Peter has also recently rewritten with the aid of ChatGPT Genesis, the first book of the Bible. So it's a kind of new vegan, cruelty-free story of creation. So that's interesting because it's about reorientating our thinking. How could we create more empathetic or compassionate classes within our school systems that would reorientate our thinking to respect all of animal kind?
Well, Peter, we have some really excellent teaching modules, teaching kits, lessons for teachers to use, and they're all free. So if you know a teacher or you have a child in school or a grandchild in school, please just contact us. It goes beyond dissection, that desensitizing exercise that some children are put through. And we're working intensively on that. But also, everybody talks about bullying in school. And there have been some awful cases of suicide among children who are bullied. And it is the nature of children to try and one-up other children and be superior to them, just as it's the nature of many human beings to be superior to other animals, not just relate to them or understand how they're feeling. So we have kits about bullying. And long ago, when the first SPCA came about, the wonderful man who founded it, called Henry Berg, was in schools in New York teaching children to be kind. And he used to say, if you teach a child to be kind to a caterpillar, you do as much for the child as you do for the caterpillar. Because if you can teach a child to relate to somebody who is so different in looks, in behavior, in culture, in language, or I should say communication, because all animals have ways of communicating, many we just don't understand or have not even twigged, then you teach them surely that it's easy to be empathetic to another child or later on to a grown up who's come from another country or maybe mentally disabled or physically disabled, rather than mock them and bully them and make fun of them. So, or be mean to them or even kill them, as we see there are racist killings or all sorts of things going on. And he was criticized by people who said, you've got human suffering all around you, rapes and murders, and yet here you are in school teaching the kids to be kind to animals. And that's what he said. That's his answer, was it's a road, it's a progress. And if you start with animals, surely, even if you only care about humans, this will have a knock-on effect.
And, you know, looking back at your accomplishments, Peter has been going now, so 1980 it's begun?
Yes, 44.
Wow, another birthday there. So what are you most proud of and, you know, what sacrifices have you made in this journey of yours?
I've never made any personal sacrifices. I feel that I've been absolutely privileged to have found something that counts, something that I care about, and something I can do every single day of my life. How many people can say that? So I could have gone in another direction and never found this, and it would have been appalling. So I have been so lucky to be able to help animals all the time. I may not always be successful, but at least this is my job. It's my life. It's what I want to do and what I hope to do well if I can. I do my best. So that's it. No sacrifices at all.
So as you think about the future and the kind of world that we're leaving the next generation, what would you like young people to know, preserve, and remember?
Well, I would like them to know that if they care about being kind, then please look at the smallest animal, the biggest animal, and look at them all as your brothers and sisters, really, or your friends. They're not food, they're not shoes, they're not living test tubes. They're not here for you to be entertained by.
So when you look at anything that contains an animal, their hair, their flesh, anything, a parrot on someone's shoulder, that somebody says, do you want to have your picture taken with that parrot? Just think, are they volunteers? If I were in their shoes or their paws or their claws, would I want to be there? And then you will know, your heart will lead you, your head will lead you as to how you should conduct yourself. And please know that if you become a vegetarian, that the mother cow who loves her baby ends up as meat. So please do not eat dairy. And please do not wear shoes made of her flesh. So there we are. That's my message to the young people today.
Thank you, Ingrid Newkirk, for all that you and Pete does to promote the ethical treatment of animals, for your ongoing courage and commitment to speak up and give voice to those who can't otherwise express the ways we make them suffer, and just your life's work in reminding us that we're all the same in the ways that matter, and that the animals we share this planet with deserve kindness, respect, and love. We all live on one planet we call home. Thank you for adding your voice to One Planet Podcast and the creative process.
Thank you, Mia. And if anybody would like any resources, peter.org, we have alternatives to every cruel thing. We have a kind thing for every cruel thing. So please come and look, and everything is free and downloadable.
Thank you, Ingrid.
Thank you very, very much. Thank you, Mia. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. One Planet Podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interview producer and associate text editor on this episode was Sophia Reeser. One Planet Podcast is produced by Mia Funk. Additional production support by Katie Foster. Theme music is written and performed by Juan Sanchez. We hope you've enjoyed this program. If you'd like to get involved in One Planet Podcast and be part of the climate change solution, just drop us a line at team@oneplanetpodcast.org. Thank you for listening.